Sounds True presents Lover and Beloved, a celebration of Sufi love and wisdom, sponsored by the Sufi Conference held January 4th through 7th, 2001, at Pacific Grove, California. Tape number GSJ3. Hearken to the call of the soul with Amita Carey.
The significance I feel for our coming together. It's a great joy for me to share in this Sufi gathering, coming together with people from various spiritual paths, and I feel that many of us, you, are on a very clear spiritual path, and yet are coming to experience that sharing with others on a similar, perhaps, or a slightly different spiritual path, finding the commonalities and celebrating the newness and the differences. And others, perhaps, are looking for a spiritual family. And maybe all together we can... Thank you. I think that's best. Yeah, and I think it's warm in here, actually, for some people. Cool for others. But we'll do our best to accommodate the broad spectrum as the sun sets, begins to set. So I feel it's a very significant time. It's the beginning of a new year, beginning of a new millennium. We're perched on the edge of this ocean, which is so magnificent. Those of you who live in California must remember, from those of us who don't, that you live in a very beautiful place, a place where the divine splendor is evident in the air and in the light and in the water and in the earth, particularly evident here. And do you know this is a place of pilgrimage? This Pacific Grove. It's a place of pilgrimage for the monarchs and for the children and those who are in awe of this phenomenon. I went out this morning looking for them, having such an analogy, having an ideal of what I would find. The clusters of butterflies hanging from the trees, and with my map in hand, and my expectations high, head out down one road and left across another, knowing there were, or reputedly, two places to look. So the first, nothing, not one butterfly. And I thought to myself, now I've read and I've heard and I know they're supposed to be here. It's this time of year. You know, I've collected the eggs on the East Coast and I've raised them and watched children watch them emerge from their chrysalid. So to see their place of pilgrimage was something very special for me. Not a thing there. I passed this little grove of woodpeckers, beautiful little woodpeckers, but they weren't the monarchs. And they're pecking away, and I'm thinking, if I knew the language of the woodpeckers, they'd be telling me something. But all I know is that the monarchs aren't here. I passed three humans on the way, and I asked them, have you seen the monarchs? The first woman I passed, I think she must have been meditating because she had her fingers in a certain position and was going quite quickly, shook her head and went on. So, I mean, you can imagine, I thought, well, I'm going to be late to Andrew Harvey. I haven't seen the monarchs, and she won't even answer me. So the next person I passed, a wonderful man walking his dog, saw me and dropped his leash. And I thought, oh, I must be startling somehow. You know, the woman in the green coat was this wild look in her eyes. I need to get back to the seminar and I want to find those monarchs. So he was helpful. He told me where to look in the grove in which we were standing, but they weren't there. So then I thought, well, all right, I've scoured this one place. I'll look down the road and I'll just be late. I'll come in, but I'll be late because I really want to see these monarchs. And I went down the path down the road and passed a man getting out of his car. and asked him, were the butterflies there? Now, this person was a little more helpful. He said, yes, welcome. Come on in and find a seat. There are places along the wall over here. There are fewer this year. Okay, I thought, it's not me, it's situation. And but they're here, so keep looking. And they're down in the other grove. So I went to the other grove and couldn't quite figure out how to get in, but when I passed the elementary school, I knew I was on the right track because they had these big butterflies on their walls. You couldn't miss it. And little children, a few, but then I thought, I don't know, maybe this isn't a school day for children in California. They weren't in the school anyway. Maybe I couldn't figure out why they weren't there. But so I continued on my way and saw one butterfly. And I thought, aha, I'm really getting close. You know, I've seen one. At least I've seen one butterfly. And I thought, you know, having read this book that's for sale over in the store over here, that if, you know, it's warm enough, they'll if they feel the temperature dropping, they'll go back to where they're roosting. So I was watching to see if it would give me a clue. And it was just hovering around this one bush that it was perfectly content to drink from. So being a little impatient, I walked on thinking I'd see another butterfly a little further down the road. And sure enough, I did. And realized I hadn't gone quite far enough to get to the entrance, so walked in and began to see a few more of these monarchs. Now, what was so interesting to me is that there was a building in the middle of this one grove that's totally in ruins. I have no idea what it is, but I thought, well, this is good. This is a sign. Dervishes sit in ruins, so I'll go sit on the stairs and see what happens, see if I can see any more of these butterflies. And little by little, children came through. They'd be pulling their parents behind them, and they're all looking for the butterflies. And sure enough, they spot the one that I had seen where they were in the sun, and then a few more in different places. And grandma's coming in tow a little later behind them. So it made me quite happy, especially to hear one man say, oh yes, they're nesting more heavily, or they're roosting more heavily in a town nearby. I've forgotten the name of the town. But I say this because to me it's a metaphor of our journey, of our coming together. You know, these monarchs that come here, interestingly enough, they have, they're the fourth generation of the butterflies for that season. And they didn't leave from this place. Their great-great grandmothers and grandfathers left from here and went to the milkweed plants all up and down the Rockies. And the second generation and the third generation, and by late summer, then these are the ones that fly back to either to Mexico or to California. So it's a puzzle to scientists because they don't know how this could have been imprinted on them. And the analogy is so spectacular because it says, they question, are they following an inner instinct, something that has been inherited, you know, genetically? Are they following a scent? Are they following tracks in the wind patterns? So this is so analogous to what the Sufis say about looking in the world for the footprints of God, looking for the signs, the ayat, the clues of God. So when I heard this, I thought, this is a magnificent analogy for what we're doing here. They come here and they go they go into a kind of hibernation. They're holding the life of their community here, all together in a colony, before then, when it comes to early spring or late winter, they go out into the rest of the world where they all disperse throughout North America, where they go to live and breed and lay their eggs and the generations continue. So I feel this for us, that in a sense we're coming here, and both Llewellyn and Andrew spoke of it so eloquently, I would say for ourselves, but also for each other and for our communities. And what we do here will have an impact that goes beyond who we think we are. So we come to share this time together and hopefully to do some work, having been so inspired both in the silence and with the passion and the drama of the words, to dig more deeply into this communion. So does this speak to you? Yes, this is why you're here. What Sufism has to offer is a change of perspective. I got this card. You probably have one too in your bathroom. It says, I forgot it because I wasn't sure I'd be able to remember it exactly. It says, here's how you can help. A towel substitute body. On the rack means I'll use it again. A towel on the floor means please exchange. Now what does that mean to me? Here we are. We can hang ourselves on this rack. Again and again. And at a certain point, we're figuring out how it's done. Whether it's attitude, perspective, relationship, thought, an emotion, a body, a life. Please exchange. So Sufism offers a perspective. And in this dialogue of lover and beloved, there are always amongst the Sufis these two points of view, the personal and the divine, the lover, the beloved, and then that force which unites them. The Sufis call it the divine-ish nostalgia, that love. And it's paradoxical, as most of these Sufi phrases are, because they're reflective of a perspective that is extraordinary. And so we can consider this divine-ish from two points of view, from the personal point of view, this longing for the divine, this longing to know our source, to return to the home of our soul, to continue on this deep pilgrimage. And not just from the divine point of view, but also from the divine point of view, this desire to be in the world, fully engaged in life, helping to be a part of building an ideal. Maybe we can't even articulate it clearly, but it's deeply embedded in our heart and in our soul. We want this to be a beautiful place, and we want to be part of it. So in a sense, it's combining the way of the hermits and the ascetics of the past with the way of the way of service in the world. And Andrew said it beautifully this morning, mystic activism. So these are these two poles of our being. We feel that sometimes pulling us apart, the difficulties of being in the world, of living with other people, of integrating what we've come to know so far and living it fully and opening, allowing ourselves to be stretched and open to go further. So we have this incredible nostalgia for a freedom from all of the limitations, all of the difficulties, to know that and live in that place of our soul that is ours by divine right. Emily Dickinson says it beautifully, mine by divine right. And also this desire to be and to become, never to stop growing like we think we could anyway. So there's much that we can do to know those two poles better and to integrate them. And what I'd like to do is to share with you over the time we have together some of the spiritual practices that, in my experience, have aided this journey. So I'd actually like to begin where Llewellyn left off in the meditation on the heart. And I'm sure many of you, I feel this, are know this place in your being. You know, there's a physical center, the heart plexus, and you can even feel on your sternum a little place that's more tender than those other little indentations, and behind which is over to the left, your physical heart. And you can place your breath in this center and blow the fire, this little ember, blow the coals, the Sufis say, to ignite the flame of love. So much of the time we're moving from here, you know, we're moving from our head or our thoughts. And our perspective shifts dramatically when we place our consciousness or our awareness in another part of our being, in this case, in our heart. So if we could take a few minutes of silence, and you can do this with closed eyes or with open eyes. You can do it sitting in meditation, and you can do it standing in a crowd. It isn't something that is will keep you separate from the world. And to place the breath, kind of massaging the center of the heart, both as you inhale and as you exhale. And if your thoughts are drawn away, just gently return them to this center. And for those of us that appreciate a touch, even a touch at the heart center, can bring that presence of the breath back into that place. And you might feel something. You might feel a pressure or a warmth or a tightness. And just like with anything else, like a massage, when something is warm and softens, it lengthens and it opens. and then can accommodate more. Perhaps if you're a person who can relate to a visual image, there's a beautiful image of standing at the edge of the ocean. Here we are, perched at the edge of the ocean. And let's say, how willing are we to dive right in? You know, once again, when I was at the ocean yesterday, it's the children who go in unabashedly, and parents have on shoes and long pants and, you know, a watchful eye. But it's good. It's good, but it's the children who are ready to dive right in. So we stand at the edge of this ocean of heart. And in this, let's say, willingness, can plunge from this somatic space, this space even within the body, to what the Sufis call a subtler space, latifa. Latif means fine, subtle. Subtle center. And then at a certain point, withdraw the concentration of the breath in this center and just be present to what comes from attending, noticing, being curious about, listening to. Not judgmental. So if you have judgment, that visitor will go. And just very watchful and quiet and curious. Like a child who will tell you his or her secrets if you listen to them, you show interest. The Sufis say that with the breath one can clear the rust from the heart, polish the mirror, so that the mirror of the heart can reflect the light of the spirit and allow the soul to unfold. So we can take a moment to honor what has arisen and to hold that opening in the heart, to consciously be aware of it and be mindful of it, so that in the course of the days ahead, we can be sensitive to what causes the heart to open and causes it to close. There's a poem of Hafiz that goes like this. He says, I know the way you can get when you've not had a drink of love. Your face hardens, your sweet muscles cramp. Children become concerned about a strange look that appears in your eyes, which even begins to worry your own mirror and nose. Squirrels and birds sense your sadness and call an important conference in a tall tree. They decide which secret code to chant to help your mind and soul. Even angels fear that brand of madness that arrays itself against the world and throws sharp stones and spears into the innocent and into oneself. Oh, I know the way you can get if you have not been out drinking love. You might rip apart every sentence your friends and teachers say, looking for hidden clauses. You might weigh every word on a scale like a dead fish. You might pull out a ruler to measure from every angle in your darkness the beautiful dimensions of a heart you once trusted. I know the way you can get if you have not had a drink from love's hands. That is why all the great ones speak of the vital need to keep remembering God, so you will come to know and see him, her, as being so playful and wanting, just wanting to help. That is why Hafiz says, bring your cup near me, for I am a sweet old vagabond with an infinite leaking barrel of light and laughter and truth that the beloved has tied to my back. Dear one, indeed, please bring your heart near me, for all I care about is quenching your thirst for freedom. All a sane man can ever care about is giving love. So when Hafiz says the great ones remembering God, what does he mean? You know, this is our great challenge. How do you do it? How do you remember God every moment? But there are clues that the Sufis have given. And one is this mindfulness of the breath and being very aware of how we respond to the world around us. But the other is to lose ourselves in this joy of intoxication, a sacred intoxication, which may manifest itself differently to each of us. Some of us find it in quietude, some perhaps in nature. Each mystical path has its mention of this remembrance. I'm sure you know of this. There's, you know, the sound, the original sound, Om, collecting all of the different aspects of being into that one sound. There's the Shema of the Jews, written in Isaiah, Hear, O Israel, the Lord thy God is one. Write it upon your forehead. Speak this when you rise, when you walk about. Teach it to your children. Love God with all of your heart, with all of your soul, with all of your might. This is the Shahada of the Muslims, the La ilaha illallah, that God is one. La, there is nothing. Ilaha, no divinity, illa, except Allah, God, who? Present in the heart. There's a phrase from the Gospel of Buddha that says, Buddha looked around the world in looking through all the layers of sentiency for a place for the truth to abide in all its glory. and found this place in the heart of mankind, humankind. So if we could share together this this practice of remembrance, and I think it starts, this is my experience, it starts with an awareness of a practice. You practice, like you practice the piano. You practice a lot. You practice reading music. Maybe you learn to read music. Maybe you don't. The only way you're going to learn to read it is by keeping on practicing. Go through all those joys, those initial joys that Andrew spoke of this morning, and then the dry places. And the mystics have many descriptions, St. John of the Cross, Teresa of Avila, the dry places of no response, no return. There's a, you know, the little flower, St. Teresa of Lisieux, in her spiritual autobiography, she was, as a young child, she tells this story that someone offered to her and her sisters a basket of ribbons. And when it was offered to her, she said, I want all of them. And it wasn't seen as, actually, I thought this was rather remarkable, not being greedy of a child. You know, we teach our children, well, you just take one, you know, save the rest for everybody else and be thoughtful of everyone else. And she was so exuberant. She said this was like her relationship with God. She didn't want one ribbon. She wanted the whole basket, the whole thing. And her life was graced until I think she was in her early 30s, maybe late 20s, when she became very ill. And, you know, there was just this beautiful life of halls, of spiritual experiences, the closeness to God. She had to struggle. She wanted to be a nun at a very early age. And she had to petition the Pope as a young woman to let her in early. So it wasn't that life was easy for her, but her direction was very clear and very passionate. And she was encouraged by her mother superior to write her autobiography. And this was at a time toward the end of her life when it was, she shares that it was extremely difficult, that God saved this narrow passage for her till the end of her life, and after having had such close communion, she said she felt she was Jesus's plaything. That's how she describes herself, to do with as he willed. So we have this in us. We have this real thirst. We don't want just one ribbon. We want the whole basket. And it's there. It's ours by this right, but we have to cultivate it because, you know, a little, you know, like the analogies, a little study here, a little practice there, and, well, you might be able to play a tune or two, and if you keep practicing, you'll be able to hold on to that one, but who knows how much further you go. So I'd like to share with you this practice of the zikr that has, there's so many ways to do the zikr. I mean, and it's not limited to a practice. Ultimately, it's beyond the practice that one is seeking for. But to share this together, to consider four directions embedded in this phrase, there is nothing but God. And the first is an outreach of our identity, the first phana, that we allow ourselves to discover ourselves in the cosmos, in this wide spectrum, this wide array. There's a wonderful example from a poem of Rumi's that says, it's talking about Yusuf and Zuleika. Maybe you know this story, this love story. Yes? No? Well, there are many love stories in Sufism, but Zuleika, of great beauty, fell in love with Yusuf, also of great beauty. But their paths were not meant to come together. And so she longed with all her heart for this outer coming together, which never came to be. But it's a beautiful analogy, and for her was a spiritual practice, because in this she learned, through the love of Yusuf, the love of God. So Jalaluddin says here, learn about your inner self from those who know such things, but don't repeat verbatim what they say. Zuleika let everything be the name of Joseph, of Yusuf, from celery seed to aloes wood. She loved him so much, she concealed his name in many different phrases, the inner meanings known only to her. When she said, the wax is softening near the fire, she meant, my love is wanting me. Or if she said, look, the moon is up, or the willow has new leaves, or the branches are trembling, or the coriander seeds have caught fire, or the roses are opening, or the king is in a good mood today, or isn't that lucky? Or the furniture needs dusting, or the water carrier is here, or it's almost daylight, or these vegetables are perfect, the bread needs more salt, the clouds seem to be moving against the wind, my head hurts, my headache's better. Anything she praises, it's Joseph's name she's praising, it's his touch she means. Any complaint, it's his being away. When she's hungry, it's for him. Thirsty, his name is a sherbet. Cold, he's a fur. This is what the friend can do when one is in such love. Sensual people use the holy names often, but they don't work for them. The miracle Jesus did by being the name of God, Zuleika felt in the name of Yusuf. So he says here, sensual people, and this is like that level of the senses that is, let's say, the first mode of their perception, what we see, what we hear, what we taste. But those senses have an inner dimension also. They're the kind of taste that we have for, you know, the taste we have for a kind of music, or the taste we have for a certain preference of dress or recreation, or it's maybe the sound we hear that carries us then into the silence, or maybe it's this touch we feel that when we take it inwardly is the thrill of an awakening, you know, like when you see someone on whom you have a crush. You feel that very deeply inside your being, that inner touch. So these senses, they're helpful in this cosmic perspective of looking at and for these clues, of helping to see God's hand in all things, even in our lives. So we'll do this first part of the zikr in this way, in thinking about this first word, no, la. What is it you would say no to? You can take stock of things within your being. What is it that you don't wish to carry? No to a limited way of seeing things. No to an ache that persists. No to a thought. No, I won't have it. It's the complement to yes, I will. And it fits very well, of course, with taking stock of things for the new year. And so perhaps this is something that you have done. And the Sufis call this muhasabi, an examination of the conscience, and it's a way of taking stock of relationships. No, I am not going to do that again. I'm not going to lose my temper when that button gets pushed. No, I am not going to forget that which is important to me. So it's a first step in a resolution-making process or awareness building, and takes us to this next place then of saying, what is it I would say yes to? To whom would I open my heart? What touches my heart and opens me? And this is very much still at this personal perspective, you know, seeking to move from the personal to the divine, but to know ourselves so deeply in ourselves that we see the hand of God working even in our own being. So as we look, we might say yes to things that we see in nature. Perhaps you can see the beauty in a flower, or majesty in a sunset, or power in even this ocean whose name is Pacific. You know, the force of the waves emerging, pounding on the shore. Delicacy of a butterfly's wings. Persistence of the squirrels, you know, going for that bird feeder, or the ferocity of a tiger. Somehow it's easier to see the hand of the divine or these elevated attributes in nature, but not often as easy to see them in human beings. But they're there if we look. You see the generosity of a friend, or the light in a child's eyes, the wonderment. Nobility. Energy. Compassion. So can we earmark some of those things in nature that touch our heart and touch our soul deeply, to which we say, yes, we can feel something beyond in that presence there. Friend who had a jar in which she would place lines of beauty. And I had another friend who heard of this practice and purchased a jar and tried and really worked at finding phrases of beauty to put in this jar. Sometimes we carry our critical eye And by carrying that critical eye into the world, we see and create before us that imperfection. There's a phrase of Vinayak Khan's that says, "Wherever I look, I see thy beloved face hidden under many different veils, and the power of my ever-seeking eyes lifted the veil from thy glowing countenance." So it's the power of those ever-seeking eyes to find those hallmarks of the divine being in life. You know, it's like wanting to get to know someone that you really love. You really would like to get to know this magnificent being, and you don't know how to do it. So first of all, you were taken by the features of their face. So in this perspective, it's like the cosmos is the features of the face of the divine being. And even in the depths of our psyche, so we might contemplate, a sentence or two that we would add to this jar of beauty from today or from yesterday or very recently. So I feel that, you know, some of us have them easily and willingly. This is like one of the early stages of prayer that the Sufis speak of, like gratitude. For that which is given. All right, so we can move into this next step, which is using the fabric of our life as this context for discovering the features of the face of the one that we seek to know. And here there's a thought, two things. One, we inherit at many different levels of our being. We inherit our genetic makeup. You know, the scientists talk about over 99% of our genetic makeup is similar. And what makes us unique is that remaining tiny but significant difference. It makes each of us unique, an individual, not to be again, never to have been before. So in this time and place, there's an emergence of what the Sufis would say is the divine beloved emerging, becoming as us, and that we have the gift of allowing ourselves to be the partner with whom God discovers his, her perfection in our imperfection. Like it says in the Bible and in the Quran, I made you in my image. And this first name of God to the Sufis, Rahman, the compassionate, God gave of him herself in creation, even to the measure of the gift of freedom. We have the freedom to say yes, we have the freedom to say no, we have the freedom to look whichever way we choose. So we inherit this incredible gift, very embedded in the essence of our being, and we also inherit at the level of our humanity, you know, each of the different parts of the brain stem carries in it the very ancient experiences we have of being on this planet, those places where when our buttons are pushed, we feel flight or the desire to flee or to fight. So we have that. We have that in our being. Or to freeze, you know. But we also inherit at much subtler levels. And the Sufis say we inherit as Christ did. We inherit all from God our Father, God our Mother. So this perfection that we long for is our inheritance, but we have to discover it in our being. So at this first stage of the zikr, we can look and see the stream of our life, say from past to future, and feel what it is we have inherited from in a kind of flow, not examining anything any too closely at this point in time, but a kind of stream, a kind of quality of being, something that we've, let's say, has borne us to this moment in time, brought us to this moment in time. And give it a clear definition, because in the manner of our intention, the clarity and the strength of our intention, just like in this phrase from Isaiah, to love the Lord our God with all our heart and all our soul and all our might, what does this mean? Even if we don't know what this means, it makes no sense to our mind to give an unbridled expression to that deep, deep longing of the heart and soul. What is it you wish for? And to place it, maybe in a little container. This is the seed that if we choose, we can plant. We can plant the seed. We can cultivate the soil in which to plant the seed, and we can learn what's needed to help this seed grow. And we can, let's say, cultivate the soil for this seed by looking at our relationships. And that's often how things come to our attention, is through our relationships. And you can begin by thinking of what it is that has impacted your being from the past, those things that we inherit that help to form the structure of our ego, our identity, our personal identity. You might say, yes, I traveled a lot when I was a child, and so I learned to be very independent, and yet at the same time it cultivated a kind of distance, maybe a lack of depth or trust in relationships, and so it's two sides there. Or all of our lives are very different, but to look at them with an appreciation and a curiosity, as without judgment, as a way of attempting to identify these hallmarks, these features of the face of the one for whom one longs. Curve of the cheek, the features of the nose, the light in the eyes. And somehow these have an inheritance that is can take us back into even those our ancestry, those beings we didn't necessarily know. We're impacted by our family of origin, our environment, our community, the schools, the our ancestors. We inherit that, maybe the pioneering spirit. I had ancestors on one side who, if anyone moved too close, within 40 miles, the neighbors came within 40 miles, they'd pick up stakes and move out to the further edges of civilization, founding America, always, seeking to be way out there, one side. And a lot of times this is hard to reconcile. And then on the other side, there's the ancestors that lived in a community for years and years and centuries, and cultivated the land, held within them the thought of their own poverty. We inherit a lot. And unless we go to look at it, it's part of us and it works in us and we don't know it. It becomes bigger than us. But when we can look at it and just acknowledge it for what it is, we have a way of turning. It's like befriending that Marie Sendak book. You can tell I work with children. But anyway, the monster in the closet. We think there's a monster in the closet. Well, open the closet door, take a look. Meet that monster. It's not such a bad monster after all. It's something also that's longing to be acknowledged and to be known and to be honored, in the gift of its being. But But then also we know we've had an impact on life. And we know this because if you can think of a situation in your life that's significant, where you had to make a decision, maybe something that happened 5, 10, 15 years ago, you can, I'm sure each of us can find something where we would say, if I were then, who I am today, that never would have happened. So that impact of those situations and those decisions we make and those relationships in life have an impact in causing a change in our being. And ultimately, like the monarchs, you know, who've come to this place of pilgrimage, we are seeking for a transformation, this magical occurrence from the personal to the divine, lending ourselves to the divine. And in looking back to the past like this, always there are things that come up that, or at least there are for me, where you could say, yes, I definitely could have done better there. Because what becomes evident is one has a scale of values. One has a preference. You know, these things we say no to, these things we say yes to, they constitute in great measure who we are. And we have an ideal. And the essence of the point here is not that this is this, you know, is an exercise in therapy, but rather looking at the, let's say, moving from the realm of interpretation of events to a creative envisioning of what it is that's transpiring behind what's appearing. What is the essence of, let's say, this decision that one fell short of? Or for which one has regret or guilt? And then ultimately to see this, perhaps, as a way of saying, perhaps it was ultimately that deepest of transgressions, which is a betrayal of our ideal. So what I'd like to do is play a piece of music from, it's called the Kol Nidre, from the Jewish New Year service of Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement, and to allow you to do some digging here, cultivating this field, and at the same time bringing this to light. You know, there are these two poles, the fana, never a fana without baka, never a struggle without an answer. Always to the Sufis there's this perspective, never an annihilation without a reinstatement. That's what baka means. Sometimes there's a long waiting in between. Sometimes we don't think we know what that is all about. You know, we have a sense by our own authenticity. We don't say, you know, we can't say, this is okay when it's not okay. However, there is the one who has, let's say, the fullness of forgiveness in his being,
All right, so let me put this on and play this for you. In just a few moments. So take a moment now to check into the inner space of your heart. And particularly in your relationship with God or the universe. Part of the Sufi practice of our school is to, our lineage, is to invoke these attributes of the divine being, the 99 names of God. There are more than 99. They come in all languages. But the practice is to invoke the, let's say, the essence of this quality and its perfection by arousing it in our own being. And so, before we take a little break, I would like to share together this invocation, if you wish. You can remain silent if you don't, but for those of you who do, one of the names of God, the divine forgiveness, is Yah-Afu, A-F-U-W. And it's can be said whispering, like blowing the seeds of a dandelion, you know, flower, into the air, and feeling the, let's say, the balm of the divine forgiveness brushing clear the space in the heart, blowing those stains or pieces of dirt or whatever, those things that you don't wish to hold on to, blowing them and allowing them to be absorbed in the universe, the one being, our mother, father, has room for all of this. You know, oftentimes it's said that in these, it's not that the quality itself is bad. You know, when you think of some of the things that are difficult to endure, like limitation or deterrence, you know, that's not a bad thing in itself. It's just where it's placed. You might call on deterrence to stop something unwanted coming your way. You might call on or wish for being firm at a certain time, but then in another time, it's softness that may be. So we don't always necessarily get a say in these. I mean, we propose, we make our proposition, and sometimes it comes through and sometimes it doesn't. But if we have the wherewithal to, let's say, look to see what it is that may be behind what we think is going on. So in this invocation of the divine forgiveness, we'll say this together 11 times, whispering Yah, which means O, Afu, O forgiveness. Yah. Yeah. So I'd like to take a 10 or 15 minute break here. And before we do, ask that we hold this concentration in silence. And, you know, if you need to walk, to walk with without going too far, so that we can gather together again. And when we come back, we'll go through the other, let's say, the stages of the zikr that complete this expression of our being by unfolding to ourselves the fullness of, or a glimpse of, this inner life. So what I'd like to do is, I'll play some music when we, it's in about 10 minutes, so it gives us about 5 minutes to regather. And those of you who wish to stay and to continue meditating in silence can do so. And then he says further, the sun, air, water, space, and fertile soil are necessary for the rose to bloom, the rose of the heart to bloom. Intelligence, inspiration, love, a wide outlook, and guidance are required for the soul to unfold. For life means not only to live, but to ennoble oneself and reach that perfection which is the innate yearning of the soul. And he goes further, he says, the solution to the problem of the day is the awakening of the consciousness of humanity to the divinity within. So we long for peace in the world. We long for beauty and inspiration in our lives, and to be, let's say, the servants of the beloved in this unfoldment. And we have our ideal, and our ideal is important because it's a stepping stone on the path. And Nayak Khan says, if you don't have a god, make one. Make one, and then ultimately that image of your ideal is shattered on the rock of truth. But the way that one gets there is by building the ideal. And it starts by digging into the soil of one's being and confronting the strengths and the weaknesses, the light and the shadow, the fullness of what it means to be human. There's also a line of Rumi's that says, come, 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 whoever you are, come. Ours is not a caravan of despair. Though you've broken your vows 1,000 times, come again, come. So it reminds me very much of what Andrew was saying this morning about the continuation of this fana and baka, the reinstatement. So we can work now to allow ourselves to, let's say, look toward this inner garden, where not only do we inherit from the world outwardly and seek to know the signs of God in the outer world, but to know this deeply within. Because the Sufis say, we create God in the aspects, the qualities of God's being, by arousing those qualities in ourselves through glorification. So it's a very subtle thought, but that is aroused in our being because there is nothing in our being that is dissimilar to the divine being. All that perfection has, it's like a mirror, a reflection in our being, distorted maybe, you know, like mirrors can be, maybe not so clean, maybe they have a little, whatever the element is, and it makes them wiggle a little bit, but still it's there. And we would know it innately only because of that connection. So, like the Sufis say, that the principles, we know the principles of God's being in their perfection, in our imperfection, and God discovers that perfection of his, her being in the unfoldment, continual unfoldment of our being. So God is not static. There isn't a dead-end perfection. You get there and that's it. So the Sufis say, but rather this continual unfoldment of this beautiful relationship with this being. So if we can take this thought of the Sufis of turning very deeply within to discover that place in our being, which is, let's say, the quietest and most sacred place from which we glorify and in which our ideal is built. And we can do that, first of all, by finding a place of peace inside of ourself. We create a space of quietude. We create a place of harmony. We take the time of the day maybe to set aside for prayer, for meditation, or contemplation, or a walk. So if we can do that now and imagine ourselves surrounded by great peace and tranquility, a kind of protection and a company of friends on the inner planes, let's say, to pursue our journey toward meeting this someone that we long to know. And in the beginning, we use these devices, we use these forms, because they're like rungs on a ladder. Hazrat Inayat Khan has a phrase, he says, it would be a mistake to consider God as just a personality. However, because God can't be limited to that, of course, but it would also be a great mistake to deny the personality of God. There's this story of Moses. Moses was walking around and passed this shepherd who was saying these wonderful things like, oh, if I could comb the knots out of your hair, or if I could mend your socks and wash your feet and cook you your favorite soup, and if I could comfort you and hold your hand when you're sorrowing, and if I could walk with you and when you're rejoicing, and Moses came up to him and said, who are you talking to? And the shepherd was taken aback, and he said, oh, I'm speaking to God. And Moses said, how dare you consider God to be the recipient of your affection and your love, and this is, God exists in his abstraction. There's no way God could be, spoken to like this. And he was just appalled. This is how the story goes. So he continued on his way, and God came to Moses like a thunderbolt and said, I sent you here. I didn't send you here to separate my lovers from me. Look what you've done. You've thrown this man into despair because he's of how you've upbraided him. Moses thought about it and thought, oh, this is just terrible. I've really, messed up my mission, or I don't, however he thought. So he went back to the shepherd and he said, I was all wrong. God came to me and told me, you were right, I was wrong. And the shepherd looked at him and said, no. You've brought me to the next level of my relationship with this being. So, but how do we know this abstracted being? The Sufis say we cultivate this in our relationships with those around us, in our manner, in our adab. There's this other wonderful story of the Sufis that there's this great dervish, and he was very magnetic, had a lot of students, and the king of the country came to him wanting to be his student. And the king said, okay, but, I mean, sorry, the dervish said, okay, but you know, you're not going to start as in a privileged position just because you're king. You know, you have to give this up and start like all the other dervishes do. And the king said, fine. This is what I want. This is what I long for. You know, what we are sharing together, what you are sharing with me is so beautiful that this is what I long for. I don't want this office of responsibility anymore. I'll give it to my son. So he came to the Kanka, to the house where the dervishes lived, and it was the other dervishes who were so uncomfortable with this. They said, how can you make this man who was a king? I mean, he has such a noble bearing, he's such a fine manner, you know, he's an important person. How could you put him in, you know, in the first job was taking out the garbage, and the sheikh said, no, that's it, you know, and okay. You think he's ready to move up, test him. So the test was that they would go out and knock the garbage out of his hand. And then they said, the dervish said, I'm sorry, the sheikh said, come back and tell me how he responded. So they came back and said, well, he snapped at us. Yeah. What are you doing? Got in my way. Be careful so the garbage doesn't smell. And the sheikh said, see, I told you, he's just not ready. So months went by, and then again the other dervishes came to the sheikh and said, okay, now I think he's ready. Please, let's move him into the kitchen. At least he can cut the vegetables. And because interestingly enough, that actually the cook in the kitchen was one of the highest stations in the Kankas. But so they tested the king again, and this time all he did was shoot him a dirty look. And the sheikh says, no, not ready. So months went by. And they continued their practice of remembrance and open heart and, you know, their silent meditation, their out loud zikr, their whirling and crying aloud God's name. Okay, test him. It came for the test again. And this time the king responded, not at all. No dirty looks, no harsh words. Just picked up the garbage, put it back in, and took it away. And the sheikh said, not ready yet. And so the dervishes, this is really a lesson for everyone. So, I mean, we know this, right? We've done all these things. Maybe you haven't.